And so I guess that's important for us to think about the broader linguistic or kind of language context within which restrictive practices occur, but also the political context of mental health facilities and people's broader lives. And so, yep, so with that in mind, then thinking about restrictive practices, they're often seen as being necessary, and in mental health facilities, we don't have a lot of legal regulation of restrictive practices in mental health facilities. We have a lot of laws that say when someone can legally be detained in a mental health facility and when they can be subject to involuntary treatment, but the finer detail of how someone receives that treatment or experiences that detention is very much left to the discretion of the staff working within there. And instead, what we see is a focus on staff acting in good faith or acting in the best interests of individuals, and that restrictive practices can be a legitimate action on people, particularly to prevent harm to individuals or to others, or in some kind of emergency situation as well. So we're in a context then where we might think, well, that is still benign, it's benevolent, it's for the good of people, but what is interpreted as necessary is filtered through or sits within those power relations in those facilities. So, as you said, your expression of what you wanted and your an act of resistance potentially to being made to have medication was not interpreted as you expressing your agency, but instead was seen as non-compliance in those kind of power structures. And so what's interpreted as people behaving in a challenging way or in a manner of concern is often understood in terms of when people are seen as resisting power, rather than interpreting that as people exercising resistance or agency, or people expressing distress or fear, or boredom even in institutional spaces. Additionally, we also know that what might be considered necessary or what might be a response to people's behaviours of concern is also related to the broader environmental context of mental health facilities or other institutional spaces. And so if you've got a, if that environmental context is where people, well, sorry, where there's insufficient staff or where there's a work culture where there might be bullying or where staff don't feel supported or resourced, then it is possible that staff will again filter their decisions about when they use restrictive practices through their own experiences of that workplace. And so we're seeing then what we, my colleagues, Claire Spivakovsky, Dinesh Wadiwel, and I, in our report for the Disability Royal Commission, refer to as this kind of whole ecosystem of restrictive practices, where we see the way in which people's behaviour, which is typically pinpointed as the reason for use of restrictive practices, is actually a response to harmful environments, and is also interpreted by others in the context of kind of broader economic circumstances, institutional cultures, ableism, and so on. So our report for the Disability Royal Commission presented this more complex understanding of why restrictive practices take place. We explained the lived experiences that people have. We drew on research that presents people's experiences. And then we proposed a plan or framework for elimination of restrictive practices. The Disability Royal Commission, in its final report, had our report, a research report. It had another research report on restrictive practices, and then it had evidence from public hearings and people's submissions and so on. It made a very narrow set of recommendations. It recommended, unfortunately, it didn't recommend a total elimination of restrictive practices as we proposed, which included prohibiting them in law and moving away from segregated and institutional style care and support and housing. Instead, the Disability Royal Commission recommended that state and territory governments work on their targets and policies around moving towards elimination of restrictive practice, but there was no kind of requirement that we put that in law. Additionally, that there be more data collection on restrictive practice, which is important, so we can kind of quantify how much this is happening, but as an end in itself, without any accompanying recommendation to be ending restrictive practice or having greater accountability for those who use it, is kind of just telling us. It's given painting a richer picture of the problem, but not actually solving it. And the Royal Commission also recommended that there be further research around positive behaviour support as a means of eliminating restrictive practice. And that's where restrictive practices are used in the context of some kind of plan that reflects some understanding of the reasons why someone is purportedly behaving the way they are, and then also recommends how these restrictive practices can be gradually lessened and eliminated. But again, what we didn't see was a really clear recognition by the Royal Commission that restrictive practices are violence. And additionally, any recommendations around prohibiting restrictive practices in law, around removing those key ecosystem factors like the institutional settings, the kind of power structures, the lack of agency and recognition of legal capacity for people. And again, there was no recommendations specific to restrictive practices around accountability and redress for people who've had these experiences. So going to your point, Belle, sorry, about the fact that, you know, sometimes things go wrong and it's very difficult for people to complain about that or to get any justice. Again, there are the law does provide some scope for criminal or civil liability when restrictive practices are not used are used without authorization or are used in an extreme way, but yeah, but it's very weak compared to the legal prohibitions we have in relation to physical assault and sexual assault and other forms of violence generally.